Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is not Rick Moore. This is Sean McCord on this bright but cold but frigid but bright Sunday morning. This scattering of snow on the ground. Love being here. Love my guest, Ray Netzel. Morning, buddy.
Good morning, Sean.
Ray and I go back a few years. We knew each other at work, oddly.
We dated for a while.
Yeah, a little while. We don't talk about it much.
Don't tell your wife.
And we know each other mostly through theater. So this is going to be part of my ongoing series for my listener. Give people a.
Did you say listener?
My listener.
Single?
Yes. Yeah, my listener. kind of an ongoing series. I have people who have managed to keep art in their lives, even as they make a living for themselves.
Keep art in your life.
Ray is currently, his project right now, we're going to lead off with this, is directing Guys and Dolls at Live Arts. And we are a little over halfway, I guess, through our very successful run. I mean, we've had mostly sold out houses.
Yeah, we've had mostly sold out houses. And unfortunately, we're about three quarters of the way through our run. In fact, we close not today, but next Sunday.
Right. So we've got six more shows. We've got a show this afternoon. As soon as I'm done here, I'm going to rush down to Live Arts. And then Wednesday through Sunday of next week. And then that's all she wrote.
Yep.
But let's talk about that. Let's talk about the experience. How long has it been since you've directed at Live Arts?
I'm directing a show right there now, Sean, called Guys and Dolls.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, so, good. Well, then.
So before, I guess, let me ramble back a bit, if I could, just to say that, about the shows, and then they end.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, they're sold out, but I would still say show up at the box office, see if you can get some standing room only tickets or some cancellation tickets, because the show is really great. Guys and Dolls, Live Arts, livearts.org. Figure it out. Somehow get in there, bribe someone. Maybe you know the director. anyway, but the thing that I really like about theater, there's maybe hundreds of things that I like about theater, but it is kind of has that ephemeral art form.
Yes.
And it will end. And it is live, and you have to see it live, and you can't have that experience, in a movie theater, or, well, you can try now that it's not a bad thing that they're doing HD, simulcasts from National Theater and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's a good way to experience something you can't experience. But, if you can't watch our production of Guys and Dolls on your phone or on a bus. So you actually have to be there and kind of experience it. And it really is brings the community of whatever audience is there that night in contact. We have a little bit of contact, a little bit of direct contact. We throw things at the audience. I'm not sure if that was in the original production. Pretty sure it wasn't. But it creates that new experience every night. So each show is just that, and then it's done. And each line is just that, and then it's done. And each song is just that. Of course, we do it again all over the next night. But I just really love that live performance art form. So
me too. And there's something that took me a little while to get used to about theater, because my background originally was in film.
Mm-hmm.
And with film, you have the sort of privilege of capturing the best performance and then editing it just the way you want it. And then, you can always go back to it.
We're going to capture my best performance here and then edit this, right?
It's live, buddy.
It's live.
This is live.
And I love this too.
and in that sense, it's like theater, and you can go, I'm in the show. Thank you. And being in the show, you can respond. You respond to the audience.
Oh yeah,
So if the audience is a little, if they're polite, and mm-hmm. they give you a little smattering of applause, mm-hmm. and they smile, you give a different performance than when you go out there,
right.
And they jump up in their seats and they wave their arms and they scream and they yell. It's like, okay, you're going to be like that. We're going to be like this.
Yeah, that's a subtle thing that happens inside every actor, I assume every actor that I know, is that the audience affects the performance, and the performance affects the audience, and it's kind of a give and take, and it builds throughout the evening. And it, as a director of a show, or a show that for some reason I would see a dozen times, I can kind of see that give and take, that play with each other, play mm-hmm. back and forth, mm-hmm. happen. Even though I'm not 100% conscious of it, when I'm an actor on stage, but I feel it. I feel that's what's happening. And sometimes, you know, if the audience is very intently engaged in the performance, they're maybe not as vocal in their reaction or as thunderous in their applause. But it's a different type of it's a different type of intensity. This is not Guys and Dolls. Guys and Dolls is just fun, and the audience loves it, and they're clapping and they're smiling and they're laughing. But I like that give and play. That's it. That's the thing. That's like living in the moment. That's art in the moment. So that's probably my favorite thing about life and about art too. Just like living in the moment.
So how did it come about? How did it's Guys and Dolls? We'll talk about your sort of broader art life in theater in a moment. But how did it come about that you got tapped to be the director of this show?
Well, the artistic director at the time, Julie Hamburg, asked me if I would consider directing Guys and Dolls, and I said yes. That's how it happened.
Had you directed musicals before?
I have directed musicals before. At Live Arts, I directed The Drowsy Chaperone. That was 7 years ago.
Wow. That long ago, wow.
Six years ago. Okay. 6 years ago.
Yeah, that's much more reasonable.
Now it's believable, right? Seven's outrageously. I'm not old enough to have directed 7 years ago. It's funny because I was thinking the other day that it just so happens that when there is a leadership change, an artistic leadership change at Live Arts, the next musical that gets directed is by Ray Nedzel, because John Gibson had who was, you know, and everyone's fantastic, but John Gibson had kind of taken over directing the musicals in his tenure. It's a big project. It's not impossible. And there's other people who could do it, but it just kind of falls on the artistic director or the executive director, because it's such a big undertaking to do time wise, if for nothing else. So John Gibson had kind of become the person who directed the big musical in the season. Live Arts usually has one big musical in the season. And then the year after John left, I directed the next musical, which was mm-hmm. Drowsy Chaperone. Mm-hmm. And then in this case, it may be coincidentally, of course, it's all coincidental, of course, but Matt, the executive director, had kind of become the de facto musical director at Live Arts, did a great job, and then Matt left. He's up at the Tectonic Theater Project now, which is an awesome theater project. Yes. From the Laramie project, a lot of projects, but from Laramie Project on, it's just a great company that's doing just good theater and social work at the same time. So Matt had become the de facto, the default big musical director, and then he's not here this year, and now I'm directing the musical again. So I love a sea change if it means I get to direct a big musical.
Sure.
At Live Arts.
Sure. Theater is very much a collaborative art. So when they tapped you, you needed a musical director and you needed a choreographer.
That's almost true.
Almost true.
Except for Matt and Julia had already had conversations with Kristen and Heather about doing the show. I was delighted. You know, I had worked with Kristen before in Drowsy Chaperone, and I had seen Heather's work before in a bunch of musicals. And I just called them and wrote to them right away and said, I hope that if I'm going to direct Guys and Dolls, that you'll still be involved. I can't imagine it happening without you. And they both said yes. And so, and it's been great. It's been awesome to work with both of them.
So how does that work? Because you're directing, and how many people are in the cast? I mean, we're like bumping into each other backstage.
Yeah, there's 23 people in our cast, and you know, Guys and Dolls, you could do Guys and Dolls with 46 or 50 people. I think that's why high schools do it all the time, because if you cast all the gangsters and all the gamblers, and there's no limit on hotbox dancers or mm-hmm. the Runyon Land characters, mm-hmm. So you could easily accommodate 60 students or 60 cast members into Guys and Dolls. But we have 23, and I wanted to keep it as small as possible because I really like the ensemble feel. So other than most of the main named characters, everyone is on stage in two or three or four or, in Jaime's case, 17 different roles and different costumes. And even a role like Harry the Horse shows up in Havana as one of the Havana bartenders, dancers. So, the reason I love that is I really like that part of the collaborative spirit. It's the collaborative spirit of building the play. That's great. I'd rather, if I'm going to be doing a show, I'd rather be on stage than off stage. So the more times that we can have people on stage, that's great. But there's a subtle thing, and whether the audience picks up on it right away, the difference between having each person be a unique person and having this company, this like powerful company, and 23 people is a lot of people already, but having our company, we tell the story. And so when we go to Havana, we tell the story. It's not, we don't have to bring in a whole new set of people. And of course that happens. I didn't invent that as a way of working in theater, but it just also happens to be the way that, Hamilton, the current best music, Hamilton? I think they're doing it. I believe it's a musical, and I believe they're doing it in New York.
Sure.
City.
Yeah. Okay.
On Big Way, Broadway.
Okay.
I don't,
So will you be directing that at Live
I'm
Arts?
Also directing Hamilton right now at the same time. It's just a little town up this. I just take the train. And now I'm also doing it in Chicago and Los Angeles. So it's really kind of strange that I have time to be here in Charlotte.
I'm glad you carved out time. My guest, Ray Netzel, who's apparently all over the place.
Director of Hamilton.
But nobody cares about that. What we're really here to talk about is Guys and Dolls at Live Arts. So how does that work? I'm curious about the creative process. You're directing a cast of thousands, but you also have a choreographer who's directing the cast, and you have a music director. Are you directing the choreographer and the music director? How's that collaborative process work? Or do you just kind of step back and, you know, when do you come in and kind of tweak and make what they're doing consistent with your vision of the overall show?
Well, you may see this as an actor in the show. I hope you see this, is that I really like to empower the artist within everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So that it works with designers and with choreographer and musical director too. So I would have conversations with Kristen, the musical director, mm-hmm. about what I thought this song should convey, and then let her help work with the actor to bring that to life. And of course there's an actor involved too, so we have to listen to, you know, how is this song sounding in this person's voice. And, you know, so as a director, sometimes you can say, I really want it to be, I want it to have this tone, so I could work direction with the actor as Kristen is working on the hitting the right notes, but when I look at songs, to break off a little bit, I always try to break them down to what story they're telling and how they're furthering the story that's being told in the greater picture. I'm not a big singer, but my musical teacher at Circle in the Square would have us all deliver the lyrics of the song like it was a monologue, like we were telling someone a story, who was sitting across the table from us, so that we would tap into that, the actor part of us, but also the part of like, what are the lyrics really trying to communicate? And it was her way of getting into the emotion of the song, or the message of the song, or the humor of the song, or the delivery of the song. So some songs have built-in punchlines, and some songs have built-in emotions, and most songs have a story, and most good musicals, the songs tell a story that actually furthers the story that's being told throughout the evening. So that's what I would work on. And then, Kristen, as a musical director, would also be listening for that too, because And I'm totally willing to share that, whether that means sharing direction or I hope that people would say this who have worked with me, that I'm not a dictator at all. I really like to I think the show benefits from allowing each artist to express themselves. So like with Heather and the choreographer, we talked about the dances, like what type of emotion, what level, say in the Hot Box Girls dances, what mm-hmm. type of, it's not a tricky one, but there could be a million ways to go with the 1950s vaudeville, can-can girl,
yeah.
Stripper thing. So, but we really agreed that the first number should be funny. And it is.
It is. It's hilarious.
It's great. And then...
And the audience loves it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's over the top.
Mm-hmm. And so once... So Heather and I talked about that. And then I talked to Kat, our costume designer, said, hey, we want funny. And I told Kat, I said, Kat, funny in the way that, like, it would be totally logical that a dancing cow came out on stage. I still wish we had the dancing cow. So that's how... That's kind of not a mediator, not an arbitrator, but kind of a communicator.
Mm-hmm.
So then I listen to Kat, the costume designer, and see what she says, see what she draws, see what she has in her mind about how that would be funny. Then I'll, you know, not that I'm in the way of Kat and Heather talking together, but they sometimes operate in different physical spaces, different times of the day, different conversations.
Sure.
But I would bring that back to Heather and say, hey, I was talking to Kat. She has a great idea about having all the hot box dancers in dressed up as sexy chickens.
it sounds funny to say it.
They are the sexiest chickens
yeah.
on the stage. And so I could see Heather's eyes open up and her brain kind of like come to life. She goes, oh. And so we modified some stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then we watch the show and we talk after the show and we see where something needs to go faster, something needs to, we've kind of missed an opportunity, or we need to make something more, or we need to go farther in a direction that we're in the right direction, we need to go farther, or we're in the right direction, but we went too far. The pace of the songs, the amount of dancing, the audience interaction, and all those things. And so it really is a trio of people watching the show and helping build the show, musical director, choreographer, and me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something that, you know, when you go to a show, you may not, you know, as an audience member, you may not always fully appreciate it, but every theatrical production, especially a musical, because they're so complex, is an adaptation. There isn't like, there's an original version you have to be faithful to, or if that's what you're doing, then you're not making theater. It's like that, what was that, a few years ago, a film, somebody did a complete recreation of Hitchcock's Psycho.
Frame
by frame,
right.
Scene mm-hmm. by scene. Well, why would you do that?
Right.
And theater isn't like that. It is this unique set of people, this director, this choreographer, this musical director, this costumer, this cast.
Mm-hmm.
What is our take on this particular work? And then, as we've already said, it varies night to night. The level of energy you have, how the audience is, what the weather is like outside.
Right.
It really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So it's beautiful, but man, you have to get used to the ephemeral nature of it.
Yeah, which is what I think I like hanging out with theater artists.
Yeah, yeah.
So much, and jazz musicians too. Well, maybe all musicians, but jazz musicians. I like the improv. People are just comfortable living in the improv
yeah.
world. So a lot of comedians, I love comedians, jazz musicians. Actors, theater artists. Another thing, I'm going to go back to I said it was a trio, but it's actually more because, like, let's say set, costumes,
uh-huh.
lights.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've seen the show almost. I've seen about half of our live performances, but I also help build the show. And so last night I was watching the show and I was trying to dissect in detail in my head, because, you know, I've seen it a lot, all of the lighting choices and how much lighting affects the telling of the story. And Steven Spera, our lighting designer, did an awesome job. And if you come to see Guys and Dolls a dozen times, on the 12th time, look at it only from a lighting designer's perspective, and that it, you know, his commitment to telling the story through lights really helps tell the story. And it's something that you see the show, you wouldn't notice. I mean, if it was horrible, you would notice it.
Sure.
But since it's beautiful, it's like, it just kind of helps telling the story. And then you're like, wow, Nicely has a great voice. Yeah. But the reason you laughed is that the light cue.
Right.
You know?
Right. And people, and it's true.
And you laugh because Nicely's funny.
People laugh at a light cue. And that's so hard to explain until you see it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So people think they may have seen Guys and Dolls. They may have seen the movie. They may have seen other productions of it.
Have there been other productions of it? Has there been a movie?
My high school, I think.
Your high school made a movie. That's the definitive.
So,
hey, by the way, that movie, when it was made with Frank Sinatra and Marlon Brando. That was, I believe, I got to check this out because I've been saying it, and I heard it, and I have to just verify it, but it was the most expensive movie of its time. It was the Titanic of its time, and it was like $3 million.
Titanic the movie, not Titanic the boat.
Iceberg, Shad. It was Meyer Goldman. That was
MGM.
MGM. It was $3 million just to acquire the rights to do the movie.
Wow.
And so anyway, it was it was worth it. I think it was worth it. You know, I don't know. I want to check the box office of it.
But don't go see the movie instead. This is what I'm saying. Why?
Well, don't go see the movie. Never see the movie.
So before we cut to our sponsors, why should people come see Live Arts version?
Because they can't get in. It's that good. No, they should come see Live Arts version. Well, there's two reasons. Because most likely, if you're listening to this show, you have a connection to Central Virginia. And so I really believe in seeing the art of Central Virginians. The first Fridays in Charlottesville, just going to the galleries, just, you know, it's where we live. And artists, maybe we can talk about this later, but artists really are the ones, I'll use it in maybe a broader sense to include architects and city planners, they really are the ones who design and create the world in which we live. So that's one reason to come to see it, because this is both a Broadway classic and it is who we are doing a Broadway classic in Central Virginia. The other reason is you have, in Live Arts, you have such a chance to see a great show in an intimate setting. So this happened to me in several plays, but I could talk about Urinetown. I saw Urinetown on Broadway. And it was good.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a couple years later, Live Arts did a production, and it was better. It was a better experience for me in the audience because I was I'm only three rows away.
Right.
And, you know, a play like Urinetown, which is great, and it deserved to go to Broadway. It was fun. It was just a fun show to see on Broadway. But I was up in the balcony, and it was it was distant.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, like, fun, but it was distant. But in our theater, we could fit about 154 people in each night, and no one's going to be more than four rows away from the actors, and so you have this feeling that, and we're doing it in a thrust, so you can look across the stage and see the audience on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this really great feeling of it is our show, and that actually enhances or exemplifies the idea we were talking about earlier, which is that the audience, it's all subconscious, but the audience has a great effect on the actors. The actors have a great effect on the audience, and it's a give and take throughout the evening. So
my guest giving and taking is Ray Netzel, director of Guys and Dolls. This is Sean McCord. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. All right, so I think we've convinced everybody to come see our sold-out show.
Yeah. Hey, I have an update here, thanks to the power of media today, is that Nicely, who we talked about earlier.
Great Pat Owen.
The great Pat Owen just sent me a text and said that the original movie box office sales were $20 million.
Wow. All right.
Good investment there.
Good investment.
For MGM.
Sure. Three to 20.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nicely.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat.
So let's move to a subject you're even more comfortable talking about, yourself. Let's talk about Ray Nedzel.
I'm sorry, Sean. I'm busy for the rest of the day.
How did this happen? Let's talk about
Ray Nedzel. How did this happen?
What the what?
What the what? That's what my parents are saying the whole time. Oh, my God. Why do we have a second son? Ah.
Well, your parents aren't listening to this.
They will. They might. They came to see Guys and Dolls.
They did.
Yeah, but they're in Florida now. Okay. They're snowbirds now.
Yeah.
They got a trailer park down in Florida. Great American Trailer Park. Did you see Great American Trailer Park at the Four County Players?
I did not see that.
Ah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, so, living the life. So how'd you get in the theater? What's your background? What the heck, Ray?
I think this is what happened. I may have been in third grade.
You may have been in third grade?
Last year. I may have been... No, I think it was about third grade. I don't want to dwell on the time, but I was young. And two things happened that year. One is that our school had a bus trip to the high school to see like a traveling performance group do Beauty and the Beast.
And where was this? Where'd you grow up?
In central Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. South Central PA.
Okay.
South Central PA. Yeah. The old man. I got the blues and the grays near Gettysburg, you know, just fighting it out.
Yeah.
Bloodshed everywhere. It's a tough place to grow up. And I saw this Beauty and the Beast, and I was just blown away. I didn't know what to make of it because, I was so young and I had no exposure to theater before, and I didn't even believe it was like real. It was so amazing to me that I just didn't believe that the people were real. Like I thought that. I still can't explain it. But anyway, I had that magical experience of like, I can't actually believe that people are doing this. And it was beautiful. The same year, I was cast in this little school play or the next year, a little school play of The Mouse, like this Christmas play. I don't remember what it was, but The Mouse, it was probably a made up play. And The Mouse was the lead, it was like The Mouse Who Saved Christmas. And
classic.
And because after I saw Beauty and the Beast, I wanted to be the mouse and I wanted to be the lead. That's all I knew. So we had to the teacher said, write down what role you would like and write down your second choice. And I wrote down the mouse, no second choice. And she said well, Ray, what if you can't play the mouse? Then what do you want to do? I'm like, if I can't play the mouse, then I don't want to be in it. Da-doom. So I played the mouse. And
so you were a prima donna.
A prima donna, yeah. I was a preemie Madonna.
Preschool prima donna.
Preschool donna. and so I played the mouse, and that story was only to get to the next story, which is life, was that I had to cry. Like, the mouse couldn't save Christmas. And so it got to a point where the mouse couldn't save Christmas, and I was frustrated, and I came downstage in the cafeteria, right? We did this in cafeteria / gym / everything.
Yeah, multi-use room.
Small town PA. And I did my best fake crying, but which I thought was real at the time, and the audience laughed. They laughed at me, and I got mad.
Ooh.
And my parents, for weeks, were trying to explain to me that they weren't laughing at me because they thought I was bad. They were laughing at me because they thought I was cute. I'm like, I'm not cute. I'm sad. I'm crying. Why were they laughing?
It's just cruel.
So thrust right into the sensitivity, the actor's sensitivity of being on stage. So since then, all better experiences. Since third grade, my life has been great.
Great. Oh, good.
Wait, that's how I got in the theater. I think that's how I got in the theater. But, you know, in a... there's even less arts in schools now, but there wasn't much in my day in a small town, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a lot of experience. I didn't really know. Well, I was class clown. I was, you know.
Yeah, you were that guy.
Yeah, I was that guy. And I was always performing. And I was always just doing stunts and activities. And I was I had this like faux cheerleader club in high school. Anything in front of a crowd, I just loved to do. So, but I didn't realize that, let me say this, when I was a senior in high school, my English teacher said, hey, you know what you should do? You should go to college. You should go to a university that has, where you can major in theater. And I just started laughing at him because I thought he was telling a joke, because I thought that you can't do in life what you love to do.
Uh-huh.
That's not how life works.
You in can't South go, Central Pennsylvania.
How can you go study something that you just love doing? But that's what I did.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't do it right away because I wasn't prepared to go to college. I took a year off, but then I went to Towson University. Shout out to Towson University, just voted the best theater school in Maryland.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Hot dog.
Yeah, total hot dog. Lots of good things come out of Towson, including Amy Schumer.
Oh.
Yeah, not in my class. She's a little bit younger than me, but she's a little bit older than me. but I think she learned everything she learned at Towson University.
My guest is Ray Netzel, who's walking us through his life in the theater. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So, Towson University, what'd you do there?
Well, I was a theater major, Sean.
Oh,
and a philosophy minor.
You did say, you said something about that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention.
And I dated Amy Schumer. I believe I made that clear. Well, Towson was a great place to go. Maybe lots of universities are like this, but it allowed me to do pretty much whatever I wanted to do. I mean, they picked a season, we did shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I auditioned for shows, and I did a lot of things that I really liked doing, had a lot of fun. I also started an improv troupe, and we performed once a week in the student union doing comedy improv. And the university decided to produce the first full-length play that I wrote as part of their season. So then, and that was great. Wow, what a crazy experience that was. And then I ended my last semester. I played Tartuffe in Tartuffe. And then I graduated and went to Circle in the Square in New York.
So, tell me about that. I mean, it's small town boy hitting the big city. What was that like?
What was it like? I loved it. I loved New York.
Yeah.
I, in fact, created that saying and the t-shirt that goes with it.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
oh, that was you.
Yes, it was me, right.
Yeah.
I think that one thing that prepared me is that in between high school, I spent a year living in Vancouver, British Columbia, before I went to college. And then I lived in Baltimore. So Baltimore's not New York by any means, but Baltimore's also a city.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't the city part I ended up, I just got more and more into. I spent a summer in Chicago during college. I spent a summer in San Francisco. So I really, really liked the city life. And I liked it in that way that a small town boy likes the city. It's just like, oh, this is the world,
mm-hmm,
that you can possibly live, mm-hmm, in this world. No one told me that you could live in New York City. Like, it was just a place that on the map that you could go that other people lived in. But wait, I'm actually living here. I loved it. So that's it. I loved it. So, and then I did a lot of things that a lot of other young actor, writer, director types do. I hosted evenings, performance art evenings in the Knitting Factory.
Mm-hmm.
I helped run a performance art studio for about a year and a half called Dixon Place, which is still going. Dixon Place is a great place for performance arts. And I did that in exchange for a free place to live. I lived in the dressing room In exchange for that, I hosted 3 nights a week. I hosted and I cleaned up the space, you know, and I hung the lights and I worked the tech for when everyone needed some tech help. And then I had a free place to live on the Bowery.
On the Bowery. Wow.
On the Bowery, yeah. It's moved. The Dixon Place has now moved to a better, bigger theater on Allen or Avenue A.
It's not Dixon Tavern.
Dixon, no, it's not. It's now Dixon Microbrewery and Burger Joint / Performance Art. I did a bunch of off Broadway shows or off Broadway in Queens, across the river in a different state, like another play that I wrote and directed called Trash. I did in a theater across from the Public, right above Blue Man Group, on Lafayette, and that was a great experience. Then I went to work on a friend's film, and then one thing led to another, and because of my connection with Dixon Place, I got a job out in L.A. On Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher.
Oh, yeah.
The executive producer for Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher was also a monologuist, kind of like a Spalding Gray monologuist. I moved to L.A. first. Well, I went to L.A. for about half a year because there were a young theater company out there was doing my play, New Shoes Cafe. And so I went there for that reason. And then with my buddy John, we got a job writing jokes for a computer golf game. So they it may have been the best job ever. I'm not a golfer, but they're like, what if we just paid you guys to go play golf around Los Angeles and like record jokes that you write along the way? I'm like, wait, seriously? Yes. That's awesome. So and then I got the entry level job on Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher, and that was a great experience.
So just to sort of put in a timeline.
Timeline. We're 96 now.
Yeah. So how long were you in New York?
6.5 years.
6.5 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. So most of the early to mid 90s, and then and then out in LA, and you were there for how long?
Just 2.5 years.
Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely, that's enough. It's enough so what happened was that the show that I was on, after I advanced all the way to assistant writer.
Ooh.
But you know what? The great thing about working for Comedy Central at the time, or a small show like that, is that anyone could write jokes for the show. Now, assistant writers were expected to write jokes for the show, and I got a bunch of jokes on the show. I just did a lot more work than the writers and didn't get paid as much. But it was kind of a family in a way. Mm-hmm. It's still like, I don't know what the show is like now to work on, but it was still trying to prove itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so it still had that feeling of like, hey, we're all in this together, which may have been the producer's way of saying like, let's work 18-hour days. it was really a great experience, ending with me getting fired because the show went to ABC and they wanted to kind of realign the staff and, mm-hmm. and it, you know, and there was probably about, 6 or 8 of us out of a, you know, but staff of like, just like 26
yeah.
at the time who were the term they use is we're not going to, when we move to ABC, Ray, we're not going to extend your contract.
Right.
Like, can you put that? It's like, yeah, you don't work here anymore. Yeah. That's what it means.
Yeah, that's what it means. Yeah.
Actually, as of now, you don't work here anymore. Can you leave the building?
Yeah.
We'll have someone escort you.
Yikes. So it wasn't necessarily personal. It wasn't like they moved to ABC just to get rid of you.
No. I mean, we've got to get rid of this guy, Ray. We don't know how to do it. Let's take the show network, and they'll give us a reason. Yeah, well thought out plan. No, I mean, you know, it's like any job, I got along with some people really great. I admired some of the writers were so funny. And they had Bill's voice down so well. It was great. So I learned a lot while working there too. And like I said, I knew Scott from the executive producer from Dixon Place, so It was probably, I don't know if it's how difficult of a decision it was for him and the other producers to make the calls that they had to make. But he was very generous and you know, during that time while I was working the show, the play New Shoes that was done, New Shoes Cafe in Los Angeles was now being done in New York. And, and so he was, I remember that now because I remember him saying something like that, that, look, you're a good writer. It was very gracious. I don't want to misquote him, but
yeah.
It's 20 years ago. He's since forgotten who I am. He doesn't care at all. But I find that to be true, that there's a, there is in most artists I know, kind of like a core of generosity. I think empathy, like that's especially, and so sometimes you would think, oh, that you're not going to find empathy in the television world. But working on that show, which was, you know, full of stand-up comedians and writers and people, and of course accountants and you know and things like that too. But there really was that same feeling that's a little bit like theater, like hey, we're all going to pull together and we're going to make this show as best we can. So I like that too. So artists that at their core are generous and empathetic.
Yeah. And I'm sure the accountants were hilarious.
The accountants didn't understand why I didn't have health insurance. Like, you don't want health insurance? Like, not if I have to pay for it.
My guest, Ray Netzel. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord hosting the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call this week. My guest is Ray Netzel. So, Ray, you've been 2.5 years out in L.A. You're living the dream, man. you're writing golf jokes, and then for a TV show, and then kind of get the rug pulled out from under you. I mean, how did you feel?
Oh, I felt like leaving.
Okay.
You know, I stayed long enough to go to my friend's wedding in Mexico, and then I just felt like leaving. It was against the advice of all the other people that I knew in Los Angeles. They're like, oh, blah, 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 blah. You should stay here. You should write for another show.
Yeah, this happens.
So I'm not sure. It was probably more emotional. Maybe it was going back to the mouse who cried and everyone laughed. You know, here's the,
So here I am, psychoanalyzing Ray Netzel.
I went back to Baltimore. Wrote an unpublished book.
Oh, wrote an unpublished book.
And sold a screenplay and worked on films, worked on independent films. And through a series of events, which I can skip to rather quickly, moved to Charlottesville because of my then wife's job.
Right.
And lived near, out in Earliesville, worked up in Greene County and was not happy.
Yeah.
I was just not happy because it was how happy I was to be living in New York City. Probably very similar. When I first moved here, I thought I don't know if I can be happy here. It's such a small town. Now, I'm not talking about Charlottesville because I was talking primarily about living near the airport,
right?
And working in Greene County and just in that, and that's exactly what I grew up in. So I was very familiar with it, and I left it when I was 17. I left and never went back. That's my perception of Charlottesville at the time was
Greene
County. Yeah,
sure.
Someone said, oh, you know what you should do? You should audition for a play at Live Arts.
There's this town down the street, if you haven't noticed.
Yeah, and I said, oh, that's exactly what I want to do. Like, signal the end of my career by auditioning for community theater. And I did, and I was cast.
What was the show?
Buried Child. And I played Vince. And now here's the thing, is like, Sam Shepard is my favorite playwright, probably still my favorite playwright.
And he still lived here in the area. There.
If he did, I didn't meet him.
Okay.
Because I was dating Jessica Lange at the time, and it was awkward for us to be in the same room. So Barry Child, one of my favorite plays. Vince, a character I always wanted to play.
Yeah.
And then here I am, and I'm doing it. And I'm doing it with this amazing cast. Boomy directed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had this amazing cast. The woman, Catherine, who played my girlfriend, had just, like, not just, but she was Equity. She'd been in New York. She'd been on national tours. And we just had this great, like, I was like, where did all these people come from? What's happening here in Charlottesville that has all this talent? And as you know, if you from around the country, live arts is unlike any other community theater that I've come across with. Sure. Whether it's community theater or whether it's theater companies put together by a group of actors or a group of playwrights or a group of directors, something like that. It is this, it's supported by the community. It supports the community. It's just kind of a beautiful place that, that I kind of, cherish and treasure now because I get to do art that mm-hmm. I love to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and it really live arts has given me that rebirth as an artist, you know, back to that theater. That's all that stuff that I love. So it, as it turns out, moving to Charlottesville and going through that period of like, this might be the darkest moment of my of my life, turned out to be like great, one yeah. of the greatest moments of my life.
Yeah.
And so I'm very happy to be here, and still now 14 years later, still working at Live Arts. Like, what are the chances of me directing Guys and Dolls, a quality production that we have at Live Arts? If I was anywhere else in the world.
Right.
We have the talent here and we have the support here. So there's the talent and the support for a Broadway revival too, but then Ray Nedzel's not going to direct that show, you know,
because you're too busy with Hamilton.
Oh. Yes.
So, yeah. Don't forget.
Don't forget. Right. Yes.
You also start your own theater company. What is Whole Theater?
Whole Theater, was my creation, a theater company, but really to do new work.
Mm-hmm.
I keep saying I love stuff, but I really do. I think the voices that theater, Guys and Dolls, great. But if it can be done well, what's even greater is new plays done by people that are here, people that are working with actors, people working in the theater that you're working in. So if I was working in Chicago, maybe, you know, with Steppenwolf, then Tracy Letts and I would work on a play together. But working here, it's Alex Citron and me, you know, working on a play together, or someone like that. So Peter Gunter, I directed a play by Peter Gunter called The Garden.
Mm-hmm.
When we workshopped that coming out of the Live Arts Playwrights Lab. We workshopped it, and then we cast it, and then we did it, and it was awesome. It was just a great two character play, full length play, and it was a great experience. And that's one of the reasons I started Whole Theater, because I didn't want to have to negotiate the reasoning of doing that and working that in with a different established theater company. I wanted to just say, like, hey, here's what I would like to do, and so I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that in addition. To doing that. And that's also, also the creation of 24/7.
24/7?
24/7? Did you say 24/7?
Go ahead. My guest, Rain Dantzel of Whole Theater, and something we're about to learn about called 24/7 on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. What is this 24/7 of which you speak?
This 24/7
right?
of which you speak, which is, I call it the world's fastest theater festival. It is where we create 7 new plays in 24 hours. We have 7 playwrights,
uh-huh.
7 directors,
uh-huh.
24 actors.
Uh-huh.
Numbers just kind of work out that way. a great crew, and the playwrights get their playwriting requirements and inspiration Friday night at 7 p.m., and then they write all night. The shows are rehearsed all day, and with costume, with tech, with lights, with sound. And then they're fully performed 24 hours after the conception of the play.
Okay, this sounds crazy.
Yeah.
So let's explain this again.
It's not that crazy, Sean. It's just here's the idea of one. If I didn't mention that, they're 10-minute plays.
Yeah.
So we have 7 new 10-minute plays.
I thought there were 7-minute plays.
They're No.
No.
Oh, you, okay. Time it. Yeah. Come see it on January 24th at Live Arts in the Gibson Theater, and you time it. The idea is to take the entire process of building a full production and condense that down into 24 hours. So that is kind of crazy. So you know, because you're a playwright, so you'll get an inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it turns into a full-length play and you actually write it in the next 3, 4, 6 months, or maybe it's a fast play, but and then rewrite it, and then gets a staged reading, and then gets someone to do it, and then, you know, it's a year and a half, 2 years later before there's a production of that, if ever. Not just because it's your play. So here we erase the variable of will that play be done. We guarantee that play will be done, which kind of amps up the adrenaline a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then we say, okay, we'll condense the whole thing down. So you have, the playwrights have overnight to write this 10-minute play, and then it gets passed off to the director. And the director has like 45 minutes to digest it with the playwright. And then they pull actors' names out of a hat.
Literally out of a hat.
And yeah. The play is randomly cast. And now here's your cast. Go off and rehearse. And then we have tech rehearsals and costume fittings and things like that all worked into the day. So it's really clockwork. I mean, I would say this. Kristen, our stage manager, it couldn't be done without her and without the rest of the tech team that participates in 24/7. It's different every year, but Kristen really is a core stage manager, kind of co-producer of 24/7, because it has to, the day is scheduled down to, you've got the schedules from her before, so they're scheduled down to like every 10 minutes. Every 10 minutes we're moving on to something else. It's not a crazy pace. It's just that we have to kind of do that to accommodate all of the shows getting the right reading time, the right casting time, the right tech time, the right meeting with the designers time, the right cue to cue, things like that. It all, you know, has to happen. All that stuff happens during the day. So it's that happens all in about less than 10 hours. So then it's fun. And then they rehearse all day,
mm-hmm.
like it's a full length play, and get the really have a fully performed performance of the play, just 24 hours after the inspiration.
I'm being coy. I've participated in this as an audience member for a few years. And then first time I got to participate in it directly was as a director. And Ray, it was just magical. I mean, we meet on Friday night. At the time I did this first time, we had some kind of our Mad Libs word association game, I think.
Right.
And then came up with themes that we were going to pass on to the writers. And then the writers went away. They wrote their scripts overnight. We directors met the next morning, pull writer's name out of a hat. And I was so fortunate in that I got Browning Porter, who was writing a play for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Local celebrity, a multi-talented man, writing his first play, and then casting it. Again, just pulling names out of a hat. Mm-hmm. And I think, I had four women and a cameo. And
you had four women and Chris Ballmer in a dress.
Chris Ballmer in a dress, yes. and it... You know, I sat down with Browning. I read the script. We pulled the names. I met with the cast, and I just went, boom, 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 boom. Here, you do this part. You do this part. You do this part. Let's do a first reading, see how it sounds, and it was perfect.
The play was perfectly cast. You also had an amazingly talented cast too.
I did.
You know, so that was great. That was a great play.
And you know, when I watched the whole show in its entirety, all seven plays, I thought, I got exactly the right play. I pulled exactly the right play out of the hat,
mm-hmm.
and I pulled exactly the right cast out of the hat. I mean, even though we had, you know, I had the script in my hand that morning, and we cast it that morning, and we performed it that evening, I looked back at it, and I said, this couldn't have been any better.
More often than not, that happens. I always remember that back to the first year when Alex Grubbs and Carrie Moran were in a play, and they were perfectly cast.
Yeah.
And Jenny Mikulski wrote that play, and she called me and said, "Hey, I want to write a play, but it's going to be really important that we have a good-looking young man, and then a middle-aged woman who could possibly be his lover, possibly be his mother." I'm like, "But I don't know if I'll get that cast." I'm like, "Yeah, you don't know if you'll get that cast, but you have to write the play that you want to write. So I'm going to tell you right now, just go ahead and write that play. That's the play you want to write. Go ahead and write it." So she wrote it, and then she pulled this perfect cast for her. It turned out, so anyway, so that does happen a lot.
It does. I mean, because the next year, you invited me back as a writer, perhaps foolishly, but... and, man, magic happened again. So I was given a theme. It was Expat in Paris.
Right.
Remember, that's what I pulled out of the hat.
Inspiration.
Right, an inspiration. And then the theme was wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking, yeah.
And I went home that night, 8 o'clock, sat down in front of my laptop, and I was told that I had two women, a man, and a cameo.
Mm-hmm.
I literally had no idea what I was going to write. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a few ideas. Well, maybe if I get, three women, I'll write this. Or I get two men, I'll write this. I completely dispensed with those.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I'm going to check social media, and email one last time before I start writing. Now, context, my dad had died earlier that month.
Right.
And it was now 3 weeks later, and I opened up my email, and I found out that my uncle had died. His only brother had died. So we lost, the two patriarchs in our family in 1 month. And I thought, but the most important thing is you gathered the writers beforehand, and you said, write what you feel. So if you were given a prop... and it's a hat. Don't just have the character come in and put on a hat.
Uh-huh.
Have the character say, "Oh, my grandfather had a hat like this," and pick it up and sort of talk about his grandfather. And I said, "Well, this is where I am right now. I'm my uncle just died. My dad's only brother, the two males, male patriarchs that side of the family are gone. What can I write about my uncle? Well, I only knew him." As, later on in life, he was an art teacher, really interesting guy. Had he ever even been to Paris? Well, he had served in World War II. In fact, my father told a story about, because they were far enough in age, Catholic family, lots of kids, they're far enough in age that he didn't know, my dad didn't know he had a brother. They went through this whole, the family, mother died, they were in orphanages, the family broke apart, he literally had no idea he had a brother. Until he was 7 or 8 years old, and this man showed up from the war. And I thought, well, what was that like for him? And what was that like for my uncle? And from that, it just kind of spun off the story, which I made up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if this actually happened to him, but it was speculation. But what would it be like to be a boy from a small town in Europe at the end of the war and being in a Paris cafe? And I just wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, Ray? I wrote seven, I think it was 8 pages, and I didn't have an ending. And I got up, and I just wrote straight. And I got up, and I walked away, and I brushed my teeth, and got ready for bed. I don't have an ending. I don't have an ending. And then it came to me, and the ending was the last line. The last line of the play, and I went in, and I finished it, and I was done.
Yeah, it was great.
And I went to bed. And I got up the next morning and I reread it and I went, "Who wrote this shit?" and I sent it to you and got the perfect director, got the perfect cast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you don't know this. I don't know if you know this. That was the play that I submitted to the Hollins Playwriting Program.
Oh.
That got me into graduate school.
Awesome.
And I rewrote that play and resubmitted it to Red Eye last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that same play was performed in Red Eye.
Oh, cool.
Last year at, I forget, 6 or 7 theaters across the country in Richmond, California, Colorado.
Oh, right. Time zone, whatever.
Yeah, they do one in every time. Uh-huh. So it's sort of similar to 24/7, except that the scripts are written ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the directors get them ahead of time. But they cast and they do non-gender, non-age specific casting.
Uh-huh.
So, my Uncle Bo was played by an Indian man.
Right.
the production I saw, and it was produced at theaters across the country and in Stuttgart, Germany. So,
awesome.
Yeah. So my point being, I wrote this really nice, beautiful play out of this crazy process of pulling names and themes out of a hat.
Right.
And art can get created that way.
I have to say this because that it was also a gift for Noel and Maria and Amy and Mendy, because it was such a great play for them to actually do. And I won't go into it now, but the convention that you used to get into the cafe was just brilliant and fun. And so it was funny, and it was emotional, and it was a memory play, but it was also very powerful in a way. Really a great play for them to spend the day working on.
We're over time.
Oh, whoa.
Can you believe it? The hour's over already. We're actually leaking into the next show. So 24/7 is at Live Arts on
January 21st, Saturday, January 21st.
Come see it. It's an amazing experience. And the great thing about being in the production as a writer or director and actor is that the audience really supports you. They want you to succeed.
So if I could just say thank you, Shira. I know that I'm rambling. And yes, I agree that Cheryl Sondas is an awesome producer
for
Guys and Dolls.
Oh, guys. Oh, we hadn't mentioned Cheryl yet. I'm so sorry.
I know.
Yeah, she's been doing an amazing job. Well, we could list everybody in the show, but we don't have the time.
All right.
Ray, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you, Sean.
My guest, Ray Netzel. This is Sean McGord hosting the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.